welcome to Reimagining the Internet from the Initiative for Digital Public Infrastructure at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. We're talking to researchers, techies, activists, academics, and journalists about what's wrong with the internet and how to fix it. I'm your host, Ethan Zuckerman. Hey everybody, welcome back to Reimagining the Internet. My name's Ethan Zuckerman. I am your host here. And I'm really excited about today's conversation with Daniel Pianetti and Charles Braskowski. They are two of the co-founders of Arena, A-R-E.N-A. They're the two main full-time employees. Daniel is a designer and he's the COO of Arena. He's also a partner at No Plans, a web development studio. Charles is a software engineer, the CEO of Arena. Prior to co-founding Arena, Charles was a practicing artist in New York City. We're going to talk today about this really remarkable platform. And one of the first things we actually have to talk about is what is Arena. My partner asked me who I was interviewing this morning, and I explained that Arena was Pinterest, but significantly less evil. It turns out that Charles has actually dedicated a whole channel of Arena to the question of how you might describe it. Some of the people have said a social place where people can watch your mental notes, Instagram without the suck, Tumblr graduation, and Pinterest's older sibling who moved to Melbourne a few years ago. How do you guys explain what you do every day? What is Arena?
Yeah, it really depends on the context, but in a very casual setting where I want to get the idea across quickly, I usually do lean on Pinterest and just say it's Pinterest, but a little bit nerdier. And then I would go on to describe like what one does or what I do specifically, which is on Arena, you have two units. One is a block, which is like sort of like a file. It could be an image, a text, a link, any kind of file, a PDF, YouTube, SoundCloud, anything like that. You can pretty much, anything can be represented in a block. Most things can be represented in a block and a channel, which is a collection of blocks. And that's almost the entire rule set. And there's various levels of privacy and people use those two units to sort of organize information, put things into sort of put their research into collections, use other people's resources as in their own research, and things get cross-connected and messy and fun.
Daniel, as a designer in all of this, the cross-connected and messy strikes me as a really interesting challenge. One of the things where Arena is extremely different from something like Pinterest is that if I like someone else's channel, I can essentially incorporate it into my own channel. How do you deal with those sorts of questions of control and ownership? And, you know, it's a much more collective model than most of us are used to seeing on the web.
Yeah. Design-wise, it's always been a challenge. For example, we do find people who are new to the platform asking, okay, where are the subfolders? Can I create a subfolder? Can I create, because they have this directories mindset. We do try to explain the horizontality of it and try to focus design-wise on the details and the single actions and to make that as intuitive as they are. But yeah, I will say, especially with onboarding new members, it's always a challenge to get them into the right space and understand, but eventually they get it.
I think for me, the analogy that perhaps comes closest is the late lamented Delicious, which was a social bookmarking site. Ended up much of what was wonderful about Delicious has been implemented on Pinboard by Moshe Shiglovsky, who we've also sort of had on the show here. This is a model that is enormously important for a small number of people, but doesn't seem to have necessarily become a mainstream form of organizing information. Charles, any thoughts on why this paradigm is hard for people to get their heads around?
That's a really good question. And I'm also just side note, I was a big user of Delicious, and essentially Delicious shutting down was one of the things that moved us to create Arena. I'm also a big fan of Pinboard. I think the reason why this is hard is, I don't know, it's a good question. It takes a particular kind of mindset where you're sort of looking at something that you're seeing and you're kind of looking at it in a more active way. Like, you're imagining where this piece of information fits into your own world, and making that leap from just sort of passively consuming something to deciding if this piece of information is important, and if so, where it lives in your sort of universe of thought. It's a little bit of a leap, I think. But I think it's something that, it's not something that is just like a particular kind of person. I think it's a behavior that can be learned. And I think it's also extremely valuable kind of behavior, especially in an age where there are so many personalized algorithms that are recommending you content all the time.
Yeah, so let's lean into that for a moment. So one of the ways to describe Arena is things that it doesn't have. It doesn't have advertising. It doesn't have an algorithm that drives a feed. It doesn't have an attempt to personalize itself to your own needs. You guys are really admirably transparent about the financial model and sort of the revenues associated with it. As of this morning, the site has 7,480 premium users who are paying either $5 a month or $45 a year. That contrasts pretty sharply to, you know, we've invoked Pinterest a couple of times in this conversation. PayPal just dismissed rumors that they were about to purchase Pinterest for $45 billion. So is this a sustainable business? And maybe more than that, why organize it this way? We're at this moment where people are paying truly mind-boggling sums of money for people organizing themselves in different ways online. And you seem to have something that's genuinely useful that people are extraordinarily passionate about, and yet you failed to cash your billion-dollar checks.
I think for us, at the very beginning, so we've been running Arena for, or Arena has been around for more than 10 years now. And at the beginning, when we started talking about it, when it was more of a prototype, we knew that it was going to be in this space where people would be using it to sort of think through their own ideas. And when that is sort of the premise of the business or the platform, having a business model that doesn't interfere with that is, you know what I mean? Like, advertising can't come into play there because you're thwarting your ability to provide that service. So we wanted a very straightforward relationship and to have a sort of motivation for ourselves to just make the platform good enough that people are willing to pay for it. And for people also to know on the flip side that is the relationship, and our role is only as maintainer and stewards and people who are improving the platform, and that we're all sort of shaping this fairly amorphous open-ended platform together.
I think the peace of mind is a big factor, because it's a peace of mind for us and for the members, knowing that we don't depend on other people and that the operation can go on in a healthy way. And of course, the first years there wasn't peace of mind because you're worried you're not making enough money to even cover infrastructure cost. But I think about a year ago, where we finally reached a point where we safely pay for all infrastructures, we start paying ourselves decently, that was a very good moment. And when we also realized we don't need a third-party intervention, monetary intervention.
So the project manages to sustain itself in terms of infrastructure, in terms of being able to pay both of you. Is there Is there donated time that keeps it going? Is there sort of community love that keeps it going? Or is this actually just an example of it is possible to run a sustainable business if you're realistic about the scale that you want to run it at?
Yeah, so we have some other people who are working part-time as well. Parts of Arena are open source. We don't get that many pull requests. But I would say that community love definitely keeps it afloat emotionally. We have a pretty active community, and we also have an API that people are kind of using and building tools off of. So yeah, it is possible. And I think it's probably even more possible now than it was when we started to run something sustainably that's like, you know, one or two people can do by themselves.
So who are those users? I mean, you've got, you know, roughly 8,000 of them. It sounds like you're paying quite close attention to them. Is there such a thing as the average Arena user? And if so, who is she or he?
Yeah, I think maybe there's probably like some large slice of the pie are people who are working in creative industries, designers and creative directors and that kind of thing. I think because that kind of information categorization curation thing is something that comes natural to those people. So it's already something that they're feeling like they want or need a tool for. But I would say the other portion is really hard to categorize. You know, I think it's more of a kind of like psychographic than it is of a demographic. You know, it's people who are, I mean, we have this really cheesy term, but we say connected knowledge collectors. And I think it's people who are sort of interested in pursuing lots of different disciplines, people who are interested in directing their own learning or education.
Arena has a free mode where you can have up to 200 blocks and channels, and then sort of after that you end up paying for it. So it really does make a great sense as an educational tool. My student Alexis Hope ran a not dissimilar platform called Fold, which had some Arena-like features to it. It was much more of a blogging and writing platform. And we saw the same dynamic. We saw classes sort of come and experiment with it, and we'd hope to hold on to a few of them afterwards. Because there is an open, free version of this, you potentially face the problem that everyone else does, which is the problems of moderation. You know, what do you do when someone creates a really disturbing collection, or, you know, someone creates a collection of abusive imagery or something along those lines? How does moderation work within the community, Charles?
Yeah, so we have a set of community guidelines that we feel like is fairly reasonable. But thankfully, even in our 10-year history, we haven't had, like, I mean, knock on wood, we haven't had really any instances where it's been too bad. There, in the case where someone is uploading abusive imagery, we take an approach where we're like a small library, you know, and we don't have the resources to sort of like debate something that, you know what I mean? We would just take it down. The cases that are, I think, maybe a little bit trickier are ones where, because Arena is sort of a research platform, those cases where someone is researching something that might be a sensitive subject. And in those cases, we've had people reach out, flag a channel, and then we've reached out to the person and, like, you know, just sort of asked for an explanation. And then usually it comes to just marking the channel as not safe for work and adding a disclaimer to the description that these are for research. And the person actually, I think they were linking to an essay that they were writing also. So we're lucky that it hasn't come up much, but I think it will come up more. And
So the current approach is essentially it's a library, you're the librarian. most things can be settled with a quiet conversation with the patron, but at the end of the day, you're not going to get involved with a long conversation about free speech rights if something's sort of abusive or difficult for other users of the platform.
Yeah, that's most of it. Yeah, that's the policy now. And I think, you know, we're kind of like, our approach is like, we use this guarded metaphor a lot. And I think also in terms of security and protection, you know, you're not like there's like a level at which you step up these sort of precautionary measures. You know what I mean? The first time a deer jumps into your garden, you realize you have to put up a fence. You know what I mean? Like we're not going to lock things down until, you know, we sort of know it's appropriate. Yeah. I know it's like, I feel like I'm hesitating on it because it's a really tricky conversation.
It is a really tricky conversation. And, so first of all, I don't think you're wrong, right? Like, I think one of the things that interests me about Arena is that on the one hand, it feels like a community in the sense of there's a lot of quirky people sort of exploring their own form of connection. But I actually like library as a metaphor, right? Where there's certainly a community around a library, but honestly, most of the time you're in a library, you're pretty quiet and you're doing your own thing. I'm obsessed with questions of community governance, but yours is not the first community that I would, you know, kind of shake by the nape of the neck and say, let your community govern, because I'm not sure that, you know, people are using it for such different reasons. That sort of librarian metaphor may make different things. Do you think of it as a community, or do you think of it as a tool that a lot of different individuals use?
I think the community side of it is the common purpose and trust towards the same goals the community have with us librarians. And I would say trust is a big factor that we want to establish. I mean, we believe we do have the trust of our community for 10 years. And again, to use again the librarian metaphor, the librarian puts rules, but they also need the trust of their guest who entered. So as long as there's this mutual trust, there's no risk of unbalanced things.
Yeah. And I would say that, like, in terms of our community, where we and the other people who are sort of passionate about this side of Arena are super reachable, you know? Like, anyone can, when you write into help at Arena, like, Daniel and I are the ones who are answering. My email is, like, straight on my profile. We have a Discord where people can message us directly. You know, we're around. So that also goes to just a level of trust and being approachable and being around to talk about this stuff.
And for the past year, we've been researching ways to include in a bit more formal governance way our representation of the community. We're still working on it, but always with the Arena approach, which means very tiny steps.
Is the community at all involved with Feature Edition, or do you have people either in that Discord or sort of contacting you, asking you for new things? How do you handle that relationship with a community of people who, you know, are passionate about this and who are directly supporting the tool? How do you handle where they want to see the tool go?
Some people are super vocal about the kinds of directions that they want to see Arena go in. And I think the way that we handle that is, like I said, just being available, but also making our plans, like our roadmap is also publicly available. We publish investor reports twice a year that we talk about the sort of long-term directions that we're going in. So I think the people who have been involved for a while have a really strong sense of like where we think we should go. And also, I think those people have a hand in pushing that direction of where we want to go. We also have an open channel on Arena that's feedback and feature requests where people will just, you know, add the features that they want. And sometimes it's something that already exists that the person doesn't know about, and someone else from the community will come in and say, actually, you can do this like this, or things like that. So to get to your original question, people who are super passionate about Arena and its direction definitely play a large part in pushing the direction of where it goes.
I'm curious. We've talked a little bit about Pinboard, which is another small user supported company. I'm a member of Metafilter, which is a larger but still relatively small sort of subscription based. I guess it's a one time fee for Metafilter. Is there a secret community of these, you know, subscription based community supported web services? You know, y'all are a little bit like the Rebel Alliance. You're sort of all rejecting the standard model of surveillance capitalism and the potential of billions of bucks for these very values-driven sort of community-led projects. Charles, is there a secret bar in Brooklyn where, you know, you all meet every third Thursday or something?
I wish there was. That seems like a good business idea. There's enough people now that there's at least a small bar's size worth of patrons.
Well, who else is in the space? What else should we be paying attention to as far as the indie web, if we're going to throw a term on it?
I'm a fan of Front Porch Forum. I think those people are really cool. There's other ones. I mean, I think the ones that are interesting, like I was sort of impressed with Basecamp for a really long time until like their recent moves as a corporation. But that's interesting. That was kind of an anomaly of a business that grew out of just purely, you know, straight subscriptions, not a ton of, I think they had one investor, which was Jeff Bezos, which is, I mean, their whole history is super weird, but, they're not a ton. I think there's not a ton to look up to. Front Porch Forum is one that I'm like, yes, they're very cool.
I'm not sure Michael is a bar sort of guy. I think you might have to meet him around an outdoor fire pit somewhere in Vermont and drink apple cider.
But he is
also a friend of the show and someone we correspond with fairly regularly. There's only one Front Porch Forum in Massachusetts, and it's in Williamstown. I'm a proud member of it. Dan, what about you? Are there other sort of indie web friends who you look at, you pay attention to?
One thing I see often is initiatives that start within individual developers or small group of friends, and those are definitely things that go toward that direction. But it's hard to see something that really stays around for a long time, and they sometimes evolve into something, or maybe this person gets hired by a company and then the project becomes more like a hobby project and then eventually dies.
So Dan, that raises this interesting question, which is why do you think Arena has managed to survive for 10 years? Surely both of you have had great job offers, other projects to work on. There's every possibility that this could have been a cool moment in internet history that didn't thrive. I think, for instance, my single favorite social networking service of all time was a project incubated at The Atlantic called This, which allowed you to share a single link every day. And if you were subscribed to, you know, 50 really cool people, it was the best reading service ever. But it lasted 9 months and then it got shut down. How have y'all done this?
I was thinking about this among those individual projects that eventually get folded. Well, for sure, patience was a big element of our success. We just kept going. And I think as long as we see interest from our community and people not losing interest in it, we technically speaking, we have a very low churn rate of paying members. And that's extremely encouraging for us. As long as we see the people stay on and they pay for it 5 years in a row, we know there's something and keeps it going.
Charles, what about you? What do you think has allowed Arena to survive for 10 years?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's the people on it who keep us going. Even at the very beginning when it was, you know, like less than 200 people, there were a handful of those people who saw the potential, were super passionate about it, and being in dialogue with those people is like, you know, being in dialogue with those people and those people bringing on their friends and then being in dialogue with those people, I think it's always the people who keep us motivated. And then I think the other part of it is just sort of feeling passionate about tools for self-directed education on the internet, which feels like they're sort of very lacking at this point. I think Pinboard is a really good example, but a lot of these things that are about sort of thinking in public, they just fall either towards this very performative model where people sort of feel this pressure of having a lot of eyes on them, or they go to being way too private and just on this sort of tool level where you end up not having these dynamics of small communities. And I think being in the middle also feels like something to me that is actually important, having this sort of public library style platform.
That thinking in public piece is something that I sort of miss from the golden age of blogging. I think we've gone through this transformation where a lot of bloggers, myself included, became columnists, right? So at that point, we have to think much more about who's reading us. There's a lot of people who were writing in public who are now writing privately instead. And it does feel like there's a real loss there, that moment of sort of watching people trying to figure things out, grapple with them, was a really useful moment. We do this show because we're trying to figure out other ways the internet could work and sort of imagine the internet working very differently. It feels like Arena has at least two imaginations. One is this this question of an indie web and a question of a web built by individuals and small teams rather than by huge corporations. It has this idea of being a web of ideas, of people thinking in public instead of sharing these things. Charles, what should we learn from you? How does Arena help us reimagine the internet, and how do you reimagine the internet?
Well, I think from Arena's standpoint, we're not people, you know, we're not like the most amazing engineers or web developers. So I would say that we try and solve these problems more from an emotional or a conceptual approach rather than just throwing technology at it. And that's the thing that I think is sort of missing in these much larger projects, thinking through these things just in terms of dynamics and in terms of how an individual would feel. I think for us, we're super lucky because, well, lucky in some regards, that Arena's primitives are sort of very relatively few. So any little decision kind of has long-lasting implications. But we get to think of those. We get to think through those changes from a sort of individual, a personal level, and having that personal connection, I think, is important to building products that feel like they are more human, I guess.
Dan, how about you? When you sort of imagine any sort of transformation of the internet more broadly, when you sort of think about possible futures for this space in which we all live and work, what are some lessons from Arena that you'd like people to take?
I like the idea of Arena being a good example of slowness that works, or the right amount of speed Going back to what we said before, some projects are too slow and they become too small and forgotten. But most of the projects now tend to, or they aim at being extremely performative and big and fast. But there is a way in the middle that creates meaningful products and companies. And that's something, I think it's a big contrast now with the Web3. The principles and concepts and ideas go towards a nice space, but the speed of it and the frenzy is incredible. And that's a big question. So I do think Arena is a good example of slowness, of healthy slowness.
Well, I love healthy slowness as a place to maybe close this morning. First of all, I wish you guys another 10 years of healthy slowness and watching this sort of thinking in public evolve a really interesting and quite unique way of expressing people online. They are two of the co-founders of Arena, Daniel Pianetti, Charles Proskowski. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us today. Reimagining the Internet is hosted by me, Ethan Zuckerman, and produced by Mike Sugarman, who also composed this music. Follow us at publicinfrastructure.org to learn more about what we're up to at the Initiative for Digital Public Infrastructure, and please subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening to it.